Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, Head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. This is episode CXCII, The Persecution of Christians. Religious persecution wasn't a new thing for Rome, but under the rule of Valerian, they intensified. Christians were now the specified target, but the executions and confiscations of property did little to help the stability of the empire. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
So 7 years before, in 250, the Emperor Decius had issued his Edict of Sacrifice, and this commanded that all inhabitants of the empire had to sacrifice to the Roman gods for the preservation of the empire. Now, this may not have been directly targeting the Christians, but they were certainly adversely affected because, of course, bishops, deacons, and, you know, the Christian faithful at large did not wish to sacrifice to the gods or to the deified emperors. Now, of course, Decius didn't last very long, and the Christians greeted his death with great rejoicing. Mm. He's not the hero in the Christian tradition that he is in the mainstream Roman tradition. And thereafter, persecution seems to have been at a local level on local initiatives. So there was no renewal under Trebonianus Gallus. There is a story of the Bishop of Rome, Cornelius, who is being exiled, but there's certainly no attempt at universal sacrifice.
Why was there the need for these kind of edicts? What did Rome think? What did the emperors think was going on that this kind of action was necessitated?
The thinking seems to have been that if all of the inhabitants of the empire came together and sacrificed to the gods, that this would ensure the empire would be preserved at a time in which the frontiers were under serious threat, and that perhaps the threats which Rome had faced were happening because of this fragmentation of religious and ideological unity. So it's always very useful for authoritarian regimes to find someone to blame when things go wrong, and they're usually people who are seen to be different in many ways. So the Christians were also an excellent scapegoat for the wrongs of the empire. Now, all we can do is tease out from the histories or papyri that preserve the Edict of Sacrifice, or in the case of Valerian and Gallienus, quotations from their laws and records of trials. But this seems to be the overriding theme, that Romans need to come together to sacrifice to the Roman gods for the good of the empire.
Mm-hmm. And vaguely, how extensive, how significant was Christianity in the Roman Empire at this point? Hard to say, because a lot of our sources are Christian. So they would go, we were, you know, significant. We were everywhere. We were picked on.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a very difficult question to answer. And there are two scholarly positions. One is the maximalist, which, you know, there are extensive numbers of Christian. One is the minimalist, that it really wasn't very popular. So we don't know. Archaeological evidence is very limited. The only site which has been identified as a Christian gathering place is the so-called house church at Druropos in Syria. And this is because, the most part, Christians met in people's houses, or they would gather in cemeteries. So archaeologically, it's very difficult to determine the number of Christians. What we can say, however, is that we have bishops, not only in major cities such as Rome, Carthage, Alexandria, Antioch, but we also have bishops in regions of Egypt. We know that because of letters which the Bishop of Alexandria would write to them, which suggests the spread of the faith throughout the countryside. We also know from one of Valerian's own rulings that members of the senatorial order, members of the equestrian order, were Christians as well. So it is spreading geographically, and it's spreading up and down the social spectrum as well.
Okay, so Valerian and Gallienus meet up in Germania? Are they in the
in Germany, that's
in
right.
German frontier at this point?
Yes.
Middle of 257.
Yes.
Make a son, Caesar. And they come up with what we call the First Edict of Valerian.
Yes. So we don't have the text of the edict per se. We presume it is an edict which was designed for universal application throughout the empire. But we know what was ordered because of Christian records. And there are two types of records. The first are letters. So letters sent by bishops, which are either preserved by Eusebius, who was the first Christian historian writing in the 4th century, or letters which are preserved independently as letter collections. This is the case with the Bishop Cyprian, Bishop of Carthage, and 4 volumes of his letters have actually been translated by my colleague here at the ANU, Emeritus Professor Graham Clark, who's an authority on early Christianity. The other source are the Christian martyr acts. So we see in this period the development of a narrative form which commemorates the deaths and the suffering of Christians who die rather than give in to the Roman state. Sometimes these are straight narratives, but other times they take the form of what we call trial acta. So they purport to be records of what was actually said at the trial, and they take the form of a conversation.
Mm.
And some martyr acts are actually combinations of both. So it's from these documents that we can get a sense of what was actually being ordered by the emperors and what their intentions were.
What do these records tell us in practice then? What sort of demands are being made of the Christian population?
Yes, so we know that Valerian and Gallienus ordered Christian bishops to sacrifice to the gods, and they were forbidden to hold assemblies or to gather in cemeteries where often they would hold their services. Now, the targeting seems to have been mainly the bishops. Those Christians who weren't part of the hierarchy were only prosecuted if they were caught taking part in these assemblies. And so Bishop Dionysius of Alexandria tells us about what happened to him when he was brought to trial before Aemilianus, the deputy prefect of Egypt. And this letter is quoted by Eusebius in Book 7. And in this, Dionysius says to Aemilianus, and I quote, "So in our case, there is the one God, the creator of the universe, the one who in fact entrusted the empire into the hands of the most pious Augusti, Valerian and Gallienus. This is the God whom we both venerate and worship, and to whom we offer prayers without ceasing for their empire, petitioning that it may continue unshaken."
Mm.
So what Dionysius is saying here is that, you know, we believe in the Roman Empire. You know, we want it to continue. We pray for the emperors and for the continuation of the empire. We pray to our God for this. But Aemilianus says no, that they should worship all gods. They should worship the Roman gods. And so for this, Dionysius and other clerics were exiled to Libya.
Okay, so they weren't executed.
No, not at this stage, no.
Not at this stage.
Yes, sorry.
So this seems to be a gentler persecution than what happened under Decius at this point?
At this point, yes, certainly. So the emphasis is on exiling the bishops rather than executing them.
And it's not just blanket all Christians.
No, no.
Yeah,
no.
But this one is, whereas the Edict of Decius targeted all people who weren't worshipping.
That's right.
The gods. This one is specifically Christians.
Exactly, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
And you know, we talked about with Decius how it seemed that the Jews may have been exempt because of the antiquity of their religion, for example, was Christianity was seen as a newfangled belief and a threat. So, yes, no, this is targeted at Christians and particularly the bishops, the Christian leaders.
Mm. Okay. What other accounts do we have then about this edict at this point?
So we have the Acts of St. Cyprian, which preserve his 2 trials in the joint reign of Valerian and Gallienus. So in August of 257, he's brought to trial before Paternus, the proconsul of Africa. and Cyprian is Bishop of Carthage, which sits within the province. And Paternus begins by stating, and I quote, "The most reverend emperors Valerian and Gallienus have honoured me with a letter in which they command that those who do not practice Roman religion must observe Roman rites." So the emphasis here is on being Roman. So, you know, if you're part of this empire, even if you're Christians, you must still observe the correct Roman rites. And Cyprian says no. He says, "I am a Christian and a bishop. I know no other gods beside the one true God who made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them. This is the God we Christians serve. To this God we pray day and night for you and for all mankind and for the well-being of the emperors themselves." So it's the same theme we see in the letter of Dionysius of Alexandria.
Yeah, we're praying for the good of the empire.
Exactly.
To the one true God.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And Paternus exiles Cyprian to Carubus, which is a seaside town to the south. The governor pressures him to name other Christians, other members of the clergy, the establishment, but Cyprian refuses. So we get the sense here that Valerian and Gallienus are thinking along the same lines as Decius. It's not a universal edict of sacrifice, but they are emphasizing that all Romans must come together for the unity of the Roman Empire.
Okay, so the fact that there was one edict and we now have a second edict coming in 258 the next year indicates that Valerian doesn't get the results that he desired.
No, I mean, there's certainly you don't get Christians who, you know, suddenly apostatize and start to sacrifice.
Oh, I'm also meant, you know, the empire settles down.
Oh, no, no,
and,
yes.
And Shapur goes back off home. And
yes. No, no, there's nothing like that happening either. Yes, you know, Jupiter doesn't sweep in and, you know, strike Shapur down. No, that's true. And indeed, you know, Valerian finds herself having to go back to the east to deal with Shapur.
So Valerian's under the impression that he was going too easy on the Christians with his first edict then?
Yes.
Okay.
So there's an intensification in 258. The fact that Bishop is being exiled does not stop Christians gathering and worshipping together. And what's quite interesting is that we know from Cyprian's own letters that rumours were circulating in North Africa that there was to be this intensification. So Cyprian sends an embassy to Rome to find out what is going on. And they report back to North Africa that the Senate had written to Valerian for guidance as to what to do. And Valerian had written back the following orders. And this is from letter 80 of Cyprian, a very famous letter. And I quote here, "Valerian has sent a rescript to the Senate directing that bishops, presbyters, and deacons are to be put together at once, but that senators, men of the rank of Vir Egregius," so that's a senior rank of the equestrian order, "and other Roman equites are to lose their status as well as forfeit their property, and that if after being so dispossessed they should persist in remaining Christians, they are to suffer capital punishment as well. Furthermore, that matrons are to be dispossessed of their property and dispatched into exile, and that any members of Caesar's household who had either confessed earlier or should have done so now are to have their possessions confiscated and are to be sent in chains assigned to the imperial estates."
So this sounds like prescriptions for a different motive, but...
Very much so. So it's not only deaths, but it's also confiscations. Exactly.
So as well as a financial motive, this really escalates the punishments available to the men of higher ranks. They're given a chance to capitulate, to renounce their heathen ways. But if they don't, they're held responsible.
Exactly. They'd lose their status, their rank. So, you know, you're no longer a senator, you're no longer equestrian. You're going to lose your property. And then if they still insist on being Christians, they're going to be executed. And so it's very much a sense of ordering punishment according to rank, Matrons are probably respectable women, so women of the senatorial and equestrian orders. They're to lose their property and sent into exile. It's interesting they're not to be executed.
Mm.
And then we have the members of Caesar's household. This is not just the slaves and freedmen who, you know, who are with the emperor. Any slaves and freedmen in the imperial service are considered part of his familia, considered part of his household. So they could be working on an imperial state in Spain or Gaul,
yeah,
and they're still part of his household. So they have to have their possessions confiscated and they're sentenced to hard labor on the imperial estates.
Mm.
So they're not to be executed, but, you know, they're basically going to endure a life of hard labor, which will probably kill them.
So why was there the escalation then? Why is he doing this?
Well, obviously the empire was under continued threat, not only on the German frontier, but also on the east. There's the ideological reason. Secondly, there's the financial reason that, you know, if you confiscate property from the wealthiest, you're going to boost the imperial coffers. You're going to be able to pay the troops. Debasement of the coinage is continuing at an alarming rate throughout this period. There were also stories within the Christian community that Valerian had been badly advised. So Dionysius of Alexandria sends a letter to another bishop in Egypt called Hermamon. He says, you know, Valerian, no, everything started off well with him. He was mild and generous, but then he was persuaded by the evil Macrianus, who was his head of the treasury, to persecute the Christians. And Macrianus was a magus, a sorcerer or a wizard. And among other things, he persuaded Valerian to sacrifice newborn babies for the good of the empire there.
Mm.
So you have the Christian version, which is, you know, something has gone wrong there. You know, certainly I don't think that is something we should give any credence to. So I think, you know, we're seeing the repetition of the same motive of Decius, you know, that there are problems within the empire and we need to solve them and then the gods will look on us favourably.
The fact, though, that this account puts it on Macrianus, the head of treasury,
yes,
emphasises the financial benefit that the empire is going to get from,
that's right,
from these confiscations.
Definitely.
So one of the most famous and, unfortunately for us, relying on historical sources, deaths that we have here as a result of these edicts is the good old Bishop Cyprian himself.
Yes. So he's recalled from his exile to face trial.
So has he written on his own death?
No, yes. Yes, I should explain this.
I gather,
yeah,
he writes on the trial.
Yeah. We know about Cyprian's trial because of the act. So this is in the second part of the Acts.
Mm.
So no, this isn't his own account. This is written by someone who was there, because we know that there were Christians gathering around to watch what was happening.
Yeah.
So we know from the Acts of St. Cyprian that on the 1st of September 258, he was seized by two officials on the governor's staff, put in a wagon, and taken to the summer estate of the proconsul of Africa, who is now Galerius Maximus.
Mm.
It's not being tried in Carthage. It's being tried on a residence outside. And the trial commences on the 14th of September with a large group of Christians gathering outside to support Cyprian. It's written in the form of a trial act, so what was actually said at the time. And Galerius Maximus says, "The most reverend emperors have ordered you to perform the religious rites." And Cyprian says, "I will not do this." And so Galerius Maximus says, "You have long lived with sacrilegious views, and you have gathered to yourself many vicious men in a conspiracy. You have set yourself up as an enemy to the Roman gods and to their sacred rites. And the pious and most reverend emperors Valerian and Gallienus, Augusti, and Valerian, the most noble Caesar, have been unable to bring you back to the observance of their own sacred rites." So Maximus then sends Cyprian to be beheaded, to which the bishop responded, "Deo gratias, thanks be to God." So Cyprian's led out onto the grounds of the estate. The Christian throng is gathering around him. He spreads his cloak on the ground and kneels for the beheading. And he ties a blindfold over his own eyes with the assistance of his deacons. People, you know, gather bits of cloth or rip off bits of their clothing to place in front of him so they can soak up the blood, which will gush out from his neck, and you know they can then keep this as a relic of their martyr.
That's really morbid.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, there's a big trade in relics in this period, so it's seen as a holy object.
Mm.
After the beheading, his body is just left out in the open for everyone to see, but at night the Christian community gathers together to give Cyprian a proper burial.
That's a very, it's going to sound obvious me saying that, that's a very biblical account. You know, just the language that it's used, the way that it's written.
Mm.
It's not myth-making, but it's the establishment of a saint, isn't it?
Definitely. These are the beginnings of the cult of the martyrs, of the saints, that, you know, these records were written, that they were augmented, they were circulated to commemorate the actions of people like Cyprian.
Mm.
And so the acts themselves were a form of memorialization, but we also begin to see the use of relics to bring people closer to these great Christian heroes who had sacrificed themselves for the faith.
Mm. I suppose, you know, that as a result of this, we clearly don't have any more letters from the Bishop Cyprian.
No, he does stop writing.
A shame both for him and for the fact that he was a really good source of information from this age.
He has been, you know, for a good couple of episodes now. And, yeah. You know, we can rely particularly on Eusebius, who quotes letters from other bishops as well for this period.
Okay, so that's the end of Bishop Cyprian, but he's not the only prominent Christian that is executed at this time, is he?
No. So the Bishop of Rome, Sixtus, someone who we would now call the Pope, though they didn't use that term then, was arrested in a cemetery on the 6th of August, and he was executed with four of his deacons. Cyprian, who was still alive at this time, said the prefects in Rome are daily pressing on with this persecution.
So all right, so going to the cemetery, even though they'd been told not to.
Exactly.
Act of defiance. Yeah.
And of course, this is where they could be found by the Roman authorities.
Mm.
Now, by the 4th century, there's a prominent tradition that one of the deacons arrested was St. Lawrence. And the site of his alleged burial in the north of Rome, Constantine built a small church on the site.
Mm.
And it's now where you can see beautiful church San Lorenzo Fiori Lumura, so San Lorenzo outside the walls. And there is a wonderful cycle of frescoes there. Okay. As well.
So when you say St. Lawrence was one of the deacons, does he have a story, a myth-making?
There is a tradition which circulated in the Christian community in the 4th century that St. Lawrence refused to give the wealth of the church to the Romans for 3 days.
Mm.
And when he did, he handed it over to the poor and the needy rather than to the Roman state. And
okay.
For that, he was executed. Now, whether that is historical or not is difficult to say, but certainly what we see is that stories begin to develop around these individuals, which show them heroically standing up to the might of the Roman state.
Yeah, yeah. And a couple of good Renaissance era kind of paintings as well on that origin story of St. Lawrence.
That's
but
right.
You get different saints attributed to these events, whether or not they are contemporary.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, one of the stories surrounds a certain Basila, who is a virgin martyr. And in the 4th century, her saint's day is in September, but a story develops, particularly in the late antique and medieval period, that she was actually a niece of Gallienus.
Mm.
And this fits into a wider belief that Christianity was often transmitted through women in the imperial household and the imperial family. That has been shown to be inaccurate, but, you know, it fits into this wider myth-making
okay.
we've talked about.
Okay, and also falling into that myth-making was the saint who tucked his head under his arm and went for a long walk,
yeah.
Which his name I can't recall at the moment, and I suppose you don't want to go into too much. But what I'm kind of curious then is with all of these different accounts that you have of people who were martyred and executed during this time, how much do you think actually went on?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, certainly I believe that there was widespread execution and persecution of Christians throughout the empire. We know this from martyr acts, not only in Africa and Rome, but also Egypt and Spain as well. The Bishop Fructusus of Tarraco and two of his deacons were arrested, and the governor sentenced them to be burned alive in the amphitheatre.
Mm.
But then what you have is, you know, these traditions about the martyrs. It fills a need. It fills a need among the Christian community, not only to have the figures, but also to have, you know, the anecdotes and the stories surrounding them.
Yeah, these stories in particular show the strength of belief.
Yeah, very much
and,
so.
And, you know, how much these people are willing to give up for what they believe in.
Yes.
And that even the risk of persecution and death isn't going to stop them from doing it. And having your head cut off isn't going to stop you from doing a few short miles.
Yes, exactly.
have you seen that guy's statues?
Yeah, yeah. It's Saint Denis is what Matt is talking about.
Quite something. So these edicts are enforced for the rest of the reign of Valerian. Can I say
yes,
that?
Yes, they're not rescinded until 260 after Valerian has ceased to be emperor, as I don't want to spoil the events. So we know that Gallienus withdrew the orders and the bishops of Egypt wrote to him for clarification. Then Gallienus wrote back to them with what's known as a rescript. And then this is cited by Eusebius, the Christian historian.
Mm-hmm.
So I will read this out. And Eusebius specifically says that he has translated it from Latin into Greek. So it says, the emperor Caesar Publius Licinius Gallienus appeals Felix Augustus to Dionysius and Pinnus and Demetrius and the other bishops. I have ordered that the benefits of my bounty should be spread throughout all the world. Namely, that they, the Romans, should depart from the places of worship. Therefore, you too are entitled to make use of the provisions contained in my rescript, so that none may molest you. And this thing, which it is within your power to accomplish, has long since been granted by me. Therefore, Aurelius Quirinus, the procurator of the treasury, will observe the provisions granted by me. Now, this is very much legalese here, but what he's saying is that, you know, you have freedom to worship, to gather again, you will not be harassed, and that you can have your property back as well. The persecution was ordered by Valerian and Gallienus and also by the Caesars when they were in office. So Gallienus' name was on them. However, he is given great credit for the rescinding of the orders, and 260 is often referred to as a turning point, the peace of the church or the peace of Gallienus, which would then last until AD 303 with the first tetrarchic persecution edict. So Gallienus is definitely given credit by the Christians for this about face.
Okay, so why did Gallienus do this then? Because I imagine that circumstances haven't changed for him as far as instability in the empire, probably needing to pay the troops. Mm. But I gather that there is a certain amount of unpopularity with these ideas, especially if Christianity is as widespread as we suspect at the time.
Yes, certainly there would be resistance. It wasn't working how they thought it would be. There is still instability, but the change of heart seems to have been occasioned by an event which took place in 260 and which shook the empire to its core, and that is the defeat of Valerian in battle and his capture by Shapur, the Persians, the first Roman emperor to ever be captured in battle. And this led Gallienus to take this drastic decision and restore the rights of the Christians.
That's Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review, they are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on our Facebook page, or you can follow both of us on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.